and our eyes be hurt by that, let alone consider God and His greatness. And so, end of verse 22, he says, with God is awesome majesty. As for the Almighty, we cannot find Him. He is excellent in power, in judgment, and abundant justice. He does not oppress. Therefore, men fear Him. He shows no partiality to any who are wise of heart. And that is how Elihu finishes, with these great things spoken of the nature of God. Excellent in power and judgment and abundant justice. And so we think Elihu is right about that. Now, then we have this moment. After all of these conversations, after all of this talk, back and forth between Job and his friends, including Elihu, and Job, as he had finished in the end of chapter 31, when he said in verse 35, "Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my mark. Oh, that the Almighty would answer me." And that's basically the conclusion of Job's remarks. And now, sure enough, the Lord answers Job. He answers him out of the whirlwind. And we talked last week about how great and mighty this would likely have been, a display of God's power. And I think something that would have struck fear in the hearts of these men. We talked about other times when God appeared to people in storms and in big ways with thunder and lightning and where the people were afraid. But here he answers him out of the whirlwind. Speaks to Job out of the whirlwind. I was sharing this part of the book of Job with Grant yesterday. We were talking through this, and I read him these final chapters here. And I said, you know, the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, and he said, "I'm afraid of whirlwinds that don't even speak." I thought, yes, that's right, Grant. Even the whirlwinds that don't talk to us are very frightening, and let alone one that speaks to you and it's the voice of God. I thought, that's just perfect. Well said. So, he says, as he opens, "Who is this who darkens counsel? Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. And so this is the beginning of what God has to say to Job, and it's the first of two discourses. We can kind of divide things up, because we'll see God speaking to Job here in chapter 38, and he will continue on into chapter 39, and there'll be a pause. Job will answer and speak very briefly, and then God will start in again on the second discourse. And that's what we'll see here as we proceed. So, now God speaks to him. And he starts in this pattern with a list of questions. And so he starts in verse 4, "Where were you? Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth?" So, very first question has a piece of information to Job. I laid the foundations of the earth. Where were you when that happened? Tell me if you have understanding. This phrase, tell me if you have understanding, is going to come up a couple more times. For example, we'll see it in verse 18, a form of it, where he says, tell me if you know all this. Later in, it's dropping down to verse 36, another form of it. Who's put wisdom in the mind? Who's given understanding to the heart? Let's see, where is that? I think I missed my mark of where I put the other ones. But you get that sense that he on some occasions will say, you know, here's a question. Now answer me. Tell me. Now, some of these, Job doesn't immediately respond, but he's prompting him to think. You know, if you know this answer, well, obviously Job doesn't. You know, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? And Job, well, I wasn't even there. I didn't even exist would be what's rolling through his mind. He continues in verse 5, who determined its measurements? Surely you know. You know, here's, it's like, don't you know this, Job? Come on. Or who stretched the line upon it? Who measured this out? Who laid the measuring line on this? To what were its foundations fastened? Here you have the foundations of the earth. Well, what was it attached to? You know, it's almost that question of, well, what came before that? Well, what came before that? Well, here's the foundation of the earth. Well, what was it attached to? What's the answer to that? Who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? He's talking about the creation. In that day when I created all of this, where were you, Job? The sons of God shouted for joy. The angels, I think, in some translations will say. So, in his opening remarks, he has Job call to mind and think about the very creation and the very foundation of all of this earth. Let's draw your mind back to that. Where were you? And I think there's an immediate recognition as we read this of God's greatness and our smallness and just how small and insignificant we are in relation to God just by looking at the creation alone at the very beginning. Yes.
In the way that it's described. But when you look at the details that he gives here on creation, it's really an answer.
Yes. Yes. So she's saying that there's, in the account, Genesis 1 and 2 of the creation, it's almost like a listing. This was created, in almost text form. And then this gives you that behind the scenes. Here's God describing what was happening. This is God's description. And there's the morning stars sing together, the sons of God, the angels shouting for joy. This was a grand event in the heavens of what was going on here. And I appreciate that as well. And that's kind of gets you excited about what was happening, you know, behind the scenes. And don't we love that when we hear these kinds of descriptions from God Himself? This was what was going on. So we'll see more of that. And that's the whole point of this discussion, is to see the mightiness and the awesomeness of God. So, this next section, verses 8 through 11, who, he continues, or who would shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment. You hear that? When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band. When I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors. He's talking about the ocean. He's talking about the seas, the waters. And this is one of my favorite verses. When I said, this far you may come, but no farther. And here, your proud waves must stop. Do you think of this passage whenever you go to the beach? You're stood on the beach and the waves come. I'll tell you, the Gulf of Mexico is beautiful and the waves coming in. Some of you know this, but I grew up on the West Coast. Well, maybe I have a little bias, but when I go to the West Coast, the Oregon coast, the Washington coast, and the coast and the beach and the surf of the Pacific Ocean over there is so powerful. When it's just thundering powerful, and more so than the Atlantic, the Pacific is so powerful. And you just think about this verse that, I mean, you think, well, what's halting that? What's keeping that from happening? And God drew the lines. You will go no further than this. Here, your proud waves must stop. I love that. I love that idea.
In Luke 8, verse 24 and 25, Jesus is there in the boat, remember the wave, how they were worried about perishing. He just rebuked them and stopped.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
How much it builds back to this.
What is the number 87? Greg will lead this often. And I almost cry every time I read these verses. Be still, my soul. The waves and the winds still know his voice who ruled them while he dwelt below. Recalling that, you know, it's like, Even the creation knows him, knows his creator. And we need to pay attention to that. And I think those are some fascinating thoughts. So we'll continue on. Okay. So now, let's see. Let me get to where we were. All right, so verses 12 through 15. Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? So now we're talking about the sunrise in the morning. Have you commanded that since your days began? I have, is what God's saying. I'm in control of that. I cause that sun to come up every morning. And look at the poetic language, that it takes hold of the ends of the earth. I think one of the versions, that it takes the skirts and just shakes out the wicked. Okay? That it's the wicked be shaken out of it. Well, what is the wicked? It's in darkness, right? And so the light that comes from the sun in the morning causes the wicked to run and hide. They don't like the light, do they? They dwell in the darkness. They do their evil deeds in the darkness. And so when daylight comes, it's like, I'm out of here. I don't want to be exposed. The earth takes on form like clay under a seal. It stands out like a garment. As the sun rises up, you have that opportunity of watching the sunrise in the morning. I say it's one of my favorite times of day. I just don't get to see it very often. But I love it. When to stand there before the sun comes up and to watch, and your eyes are adjusting, everything's dark, and you see just this vague shape of something, and you can't quite make it out, but you keep looking and keep looking, and that sun keeps coming up, and it starts to take form. More and more you start seeing the edges of it, you start seeing the detail of it. Now you start knowing what you're looking at. It takes on form like clay under a seal. Takes on this clay being shaped under a seal. Stands out like a garment. Now I see it. And from the wicked, their light is withheld. And the upraised arm is broken. I think that's just relating to the fact that the wickedness is just revealed in all of this, and they are caused to run and hide. So, that is some comments about the sun rising. All right. Now, verses 16 through 18. I think this, I want to get to in this section, the NIV reading of this is a little easier to me. The NIV says, "Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the deepest darkness? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this." So, notice God is saying, have you gone to this extent? You know, have you seen the springs of the sea? Have you seen the depth of the ocean? The gates of the deepest darkness? Have you been able to travel there and see that? Oh, we can't get there. The deepest parts of the ocean. We can't even get down there. We can't even get halfway down before the pressure would collapse us. And we don't know the depths of that. And so I think God's pointing out there's the limitations of man. There are places that we're aware of. That we know, yes, there's the bottom somewhere down there. But we can't get to it. We have no way of traveling to those places. It's beyond our limits. God knows that. He's asking these questions. Have you gone there? Have you considered this? Can you get there? No. We have no answer, do we? Verse 19. Where is the way to the dwelling of light and darkness? Where is its place? That you may take it to its territory, that you may know the paths to its home. Verse 21. Do you know it? Do you know the way to the dwelling of light? Do you know where light is kept? Do you know where darkness is kept? Do you know it because you were born then? Or because the number of your days is great? Do you know these things, Job? Surely you know. This goes back to that whole idea. Surely you know. You were already born, right? No. No, you weren't, Job. You've lived so many years. No. Just a few. You don't know these things. These are questions. Do you know it? Is this a rhetorical question? Is this one that God knows? No, Job, you don't have an answer for this. Verse 22. Have you entered the treasury of snow? Have you seen the treasury of hail? Which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war. By what way is light diffused, or the east wind scattered over the earth. And NIV uses, by what way, what is the way to the place where lightning is dispersed? So now we're talking about the weather and the snow. Do you know where I keep the snow? Do you know where I keep the hail? I mean, ironic, we're talking about hail after this past week, right? And do you think that God could use hail to overcome people in battle and war? Oh, he did, didn't he? And we talked about last week about Egypt and one of the plagues of Egypt and how hail was used in that. Do you know when I was growing up in Washington State, we had hail. We did. But it was like little pea-sized hail. And that's the way it always came down. And it was usually when it was cold. It's cold and rainy. So when I moved to the South, and I saw it hail and it was hot outside, I mean, I was just like, what? This doesn't match. Hail in hot weather does not fit in my head. But we would get hail because it was almost like, to me, it was almost like a variation of snow. It was like, oh, it's snowing. Oh, it's just hail. And so I would think about the plague of Egypt, and I go, hail, and okay, this is a plague of hail. Yeah, okay. And sometimes it would accumulate. We'd have some big hails where lots of little ones, and it would accumulate. We might get 3 inches of hail, and it would be like snow. But it wasn't that big of a deal in that part of the country. And then I see what happened this past week, and I go, oh, now I get it. Now I understand how God could use this to destroy, absolutely destroy, that he could use this as a judgment against people. I'm not to say that what happened this week was or wasn't, I don't know. But can you see that? Can you see God's power, his control and his ability to use his elements, his creation, in the way that he wishes for the day of battle and war? That's all within God's power. Verse 25. Who has divided a channel for the overflowing water, or the path for the thunderbolt, to cause it to rain on a land where there is no one, a wilderness in which there is no man, to satisfy the desolate waste and cause this to spring forth the growth of tender grass? We talked about this last week. You know, God can use that weather in ways that he wishes, whether it's a judgment against people or whether it's just to replenish the earth. And in this case, even when it doesn't have anything to do with people, it's in a desolate place where people are not living. All within God's power. So then, in verse 28, what is the source? What is the source of this? Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice and the frost of heaven? Who gives it birth? The waters harden like stone, and the surface of the deep is frozen. He's talking about the cold and the ice. Where does that come from? Who created that? What is the source of all of these aspects of weather? And so now, we see in verse 31, a fascinating passage right here. Can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades? Or loose the belt of Orion? Can you bring out Maseroth in its season? Or can you guide the great bear with its cubs? What's he talking about? The constellations, the stars in heaven, the patterns that we see up there. This has been around from the beginning. People have looked up and observed better than we can today with all of our lights that wash things out. But to see the night sky and to see these patterns of stars as they gaze up and they see, that looks like such and such. And God is acknowledging that. Can you do these things to these constellations? I can. I created them. But the poetic language, can you loose the belt of Orion? That's an easy one to spot. You know, it's three stars. There's the belt. God can. Verse 33. Do you know the ordinances of the heaven? Can you set their dominion over the earth? Job, can you do that? Job's answer? No. God's saying, I can. Without saying it, he's saying it. I can. Look at verse 34 and 35. You can see similar to what we saw up in 28 through 30. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that an abundance of water may come over you? Can you send out lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? I mean, that's more weather aspects in the control of God. And verse 36. Well, look at let's look at 36. Who has put wisdom in the mind? So now there's a little break here from this weather and the creation aspects. And this question of who has put wisdom in the mind of man? Who has given understanding to the heart? Well, God did, didn't he? He gave us the ability to think through things, to understand how things work, to consider things, to develop in our minds, to have a thought process, to learn from our experiences, right? We look at the animals and they have instinct, don't they? They just like they're born with it. Well, they learn some things, true, but there's some things that they have by instinct. But that's how they operate. This is just how I'm programmed and designed to do. But man, we have, I think this is when we say that we were created in God's image. I think this is an element of it, is that we can think and consider in the process of learning and understanding who God is and deciding to be a certain way or to change and go a different path. But who gave that to us? God did. I think when he said, let us make man in our image, I think this is where this came from. Who can number the clouds by wisdom? Verse 37. Who can pour out the bottles of heaven? Listen to that language. When the dust hardens in clumps and the clods cling together. Can you hunt? Okay, so change of subject here, right? So much about the weather and the creation, space, the depths of the ocean, all of those mighty aspects, all God's creation, all in his control. And God continues, verse 39. I didn't want to miss this point. In yellow, through his questions, through God's questions, God reminds Job of his infinite power to create. Okay, that's a good point, I think, to make. And now, really, in verse 39, we have almost a different subject matter. Through God's questions, he reminds Job of his infinite and understanding and knowledge of, now we're going to get a lot into some the creation in terms of animals and how and the nature of his creation, how it works. So he asks the question, can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions? When they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs to lie in wait, who provides food for the raven when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food? Who handles all that? God's saying, I've got that under control. Chapter 39, verse 1. Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Do you know the time when they bear young? I mean, these are fascinating things. You don't even get to hardly see when deer go to sleep. They tuck off and hide. You have no idea. They bow down, they bring forth their young, they deliver their offspring. Their young ones are healthy. They grow strong with grain. They depart, and they do not return to them. This all works without any effort on your part, Job. It's all taken care of. And do you understand how those things work? So you have the mountain goats and the deer. Who set the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the onager? Whose home I have made in the wilderness, and the barren land his dwelling. So we're talking about wild donkeys here. He scorns the tumult of the city. He does not heed the shouts of the driver. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. He's wild and off on his own. Doesn't have anything to do with people. Can't be really controlled. Takes care of himself. I've got that handle. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Now we're talking about a wild ox. This is a huge, huge bull steer. Okay? An ox. Massive. Will he bed by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes? Will he plow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because of his strength is great? Or will you leave your labor to him? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? A wild ox, can you control him? Is he going to be under your control and your management like an ox that is tamed? You won't have that in your control either. But I've got it covered. Think of the ostrich. The wings of the ostrich wave proudly. But are her wings and pinions like the kindly stork's? Well, what's different about an ostrich and a stork in regard to their wings? Yeah, ostriches got these big old wings. Big wings. And they can't fly. So it's not like the stork's wings. For she leaves her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain without concern because God deprived her of wisdom and did not endow her with understanding. So she doesn't really pay much attention to those things. Lays her eggs in the dust, covers it in the dirt. That's how they're warmed. Unlike so many other birds who actually cover and keep them warm, protect them, are concerned, they understand what this is, and the ostrich seems to not even care. But they make it, and more ostriches are born, and God's got that under control too. And look at verse 18. When she lifts herself on high. When the ostrich lifts herself on high, she scorns the horse and its rider. What do you think that means? She might have that kind of proud spirit about her, right? What else? You think about the size of them. An ostrich, I looked this up. I didn't know this. I knew they were big, but I didn't know this. They're like 8 feet tall. Okay? So, a horse, I looked this up too. I knew they were like number of hands. I knew that much. Okay. All right. So a horse typically at its back on the average, about like this. That's about 5 feet. Okay. Their head will stand a little bit higher, of course. But a ballpark about 5 feet. So shorter than an ostrich, right? Put a rider on top of the horse, and the ostrich stands as tall as that. How fast is a horse and his rider? Do you know the fastest horses are about 40 to 45 miles per hour, like thoroughbred fast, typically? Do you know that ostriches run about 40 to 45 miles per hour. They're one of the fastest land animals. That's amazing. They can outrun a horse. And you think about that, and so she lifts her head on high. She scorns the horse and its rider. In the NIV it says, when she spreads her feathers to run, she laughs at horse and rider. Can't outrun you. But she doesn't have the power and the strength that the horse has. Have you given the horse strength, verse 19? Have you clothed his neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? Think about the horse. Think about the battle horse here that's described. Can you frighten him like a locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear and is not frightened, nor does he turn back from the sword. A quiver rattles against him, the glittering spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage, nor does he come to a halt because the trumpet has sounded. At the blast of the trumpet, he says, "Aha!" And he smells the battle from afar. The thunder of captains and shouting. You think about the battle horse and the things that they go through and the noise of battle. And that's not just quivers and swords rattling. Horses, even in the presence of gunfire and cannon, will stand firm without being afraid. That's an interesting animal there. Real common, much more common than what we deal with ostriches. But it's a great example that God has put this in their heart. I've created this. Finally, the hawk. Does the hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high? On the rock it dwells and resides, on the crag of the rock and the stronghold. From there it spies out the prey. Its eyes observe from afar. God created it to be like this. The eagle and the hawk soaring high above, able to spot their prey so small, with that sharp vision. That's in God's power. Its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is. So, What is God's answer? Let me pull this up here. So do you think that God is saying to Job, he's asking him, were you there? Do you know these things? Do you have this ability? And so God is saying that, Job, you don't have my power. You don't have my knowledge. You don't have my understanding of these things. You don't have my wisdom. And thus, and therefore, you don't have the ability and you're not in a position to question all that I have control over. And I think this is a big point. If anyone has answers and wisdom, it's God. He created all of this. He knows all of this. So if God is fully in control of all of these things, has power over everything, all things are of Him, and all things are through Him, can we trust Him? Oh, yes, we can. And I think God's telling Job in these ways, with these questions, I've got it covered. You can trust me. Everything's in my control and in my power. Well, Job said this already, didn't he? I mean, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. In the middle of his pain and suffering, as he was explaining these things to his friends, wondering why, I don't get this, I don't understand why I'm suffering. And his friends are telling him, it's because you've sinned, Job. There's no other explanation. And Job's saying, how? What have I done? I don't understand this, if that's right. But at the same time, he knows God's power. He knows he can trust him. Look back at Job chapter 9. Back in chapter 9, all these things that God is saying, does Job know these things? Did he understand these things? When God said, do you know, Job? Do you understand these things? Well, the answer for Job certainly was, well, no, I don't. But did Job know that God was in control? Look at verse 1, chapter 9. Job answered and said, truly I know it is so, but how can a man be righteous before God? If one wished to contend with him, he could not answer him one time out of 1,000. So Job kind of knew in his heart that I couldn't provide God with an answer. Verse 4, God is wise in heart. This is Job talking. God is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and prospered? He removes the mountains and they do not know when he overturns them in his anger. He shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble. He commands the sun and it does not rise. He seals off the stars. He alone spreads out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. He made the bear, Orion, Pleiades, and the chambers of the south. He does great things past finding out. Yes, wonders without number. And he goes on to say more things about God. But did Job know the greatness of God? He understood. He knew these things. But he was still seeking understanding of why he was suffering the way that he was suffering. That part didn't... I don't understand that. And he struggled with that thought. And that's what he's asking God for, is an explanation of why. How does this work? But God uses these things. These kinds of questions. To get Job's mind where it needed to be. And I think what Bill Grimmett said last week, he gave Job a line of thought. Here is how I need you to be thinking about all of this. I'm in control. I have power. I've got this covered, Job. You can trust me. It's going to be okay. Questions, thoughts?
I think one of the things different is that in the chapter we're looking at today, God is here. He's here from Job. Whereas here in chapter 9, you know, he's not present. And I know that's an obvious statement, but
yeah.
Still,
to actually hear, yeah, the power of that being told to him again. Be very overwhelming. That's right. That's right. Thank you.